It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll get our monthly dose of the coolest science stories out there with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak.
First, a new report out today from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel shows that big political donations from Wisconsin's wealthiest donors are up significantly since the court struck down limits on overall political donations this past spring.
The total amount of money any individual used to be able to spend in a single campaign season was $10,000. Now it's unlimited. In light of that change, 38 big donors in the state have given over $680,000. That's $300,000 more than they would have been able to do under the old laws.
Those in favor of the deregulation say this makes political donations more transparent since they're giving directly to candidates as opposed to third parties. Critics, though, see this as increasing the potential of political influence of America's wealthy.
Here with us now to talk about these new numbers, we have Patrick Marley. He's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel State House reporter, author of the new report. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, can we tell at this point if this extra money is changing the way this fall campaign is going here in Wisconsin?
I don't know that we can detect that. You know, a lot of money gets spent in campaigns every cycle. They seem to escalate, though I would say we had an aberration with the 2012 recall, which we probably won't hit those numbers again for a long time. This is just, another sign of the ongoing trend of increased money in campaigns.
So let's dig down into exactly how this used to work. What has changed here is what they call the aggregate limit, right? How much, not how much I donate to one candidate, but how much I donate to all candidates in this election cycle. Do I have that right?
That's correct. So the individual limits are in place. There's a set amount that you can give to any particular candidate. You can give $10,000 to a candidate for governor, but you can only give $500 to a candidate for the state assembly. And they have, for every office, there's a limit. But the state used to say in a year you couldn't give more than $10,000 to all candidates combined. So if you were giving $500 to assembly candidates, you could only give to 20 of them. Then you hit your $10,000 total cap, and you couldn't give any more. A man from Racine named Fred Young Jr. sued over that. Around the same time, there was a federal case that had gone further through the process challenging similar limits to Congress. The U.S. Supreme Court decided in April that such aggregate limits were not constitutional, that they were an inhibition on the right to free speech. And then soon after that, in the state case, the state conceded that that was unconstitutional because of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and the state limits were struck down.
So now if I had the money and the inclination, I could give to a candidate in every race from governor down to county coroner if I wanted to.
You could give the maximum contribution to every single person who's running for the state legislature, as well as to the governor and all state offices.
So you, in this piece, looked at who was donating. Who are some of the big names going above what would have been the old limit?
So there are 38 people so far this year who have given more than $10,000. Many of them are familiar names. Topping the list was Chris Abley, the Milwaukee County executive and a longtime funder of mostly Democrats. Sometimes he gives a little bit of money to Republicans. But he gave $96,000, more than $96,000 this year. $80,000 of that went to the state Democratic Party. $10,000 of that went to Mary Burke, the Democrat running for governor. Some big givers on the Republican side would be Terry and Mary Kohler. Terry Kohler's long been a funder of Republican candidates and causes. He's the son and grandson of former Wisconsin governors. He and his wife Mary have given $57,000 together this year to Republican candidates.
And now we're looking right now just at Wisconsinites making these donations. Is that right?
Well, we ran a list of every single person who would have given more than that. There were, as it happened, I think it was 36 of the 38 were from Wisconsin. There were two people from Texas who had given. But what we found in this instance was that it was not a lot of out-of-state money that was flowing into Wisconsin over the cap.
And these are donations directly to candidates. So all we hear about outside groups, money going to those, that's not what we're talking about here.
That's right. So there's sort of a separate system in which people can give to independent groups to spend money in campaigns. That money is largely unregulated and unseen. So before these limits were in place, all these people were free to give as much as they wanted to these outside groups, and that continues to this day. So we're not capturing a big piece of the puzzle because it's only in unique circumstances where you find that out. But for instance, Abley, who I mentioned before, he told me when I talked to him on Friday that he had given $250,000 to the Greater Wisconsin Committee, which is a liberal group that runs ads in state and local races, and they had a campaign going against Milwaukee Sheriff David Clark. Abley was a big funder of that, as it turns out.
Now, looking at these big 38, are they going? Is their money going mostly to Democrats or Republicans?
It went about 60% to Republicans, from what we found. You keep in mind, this is a narrow window here. It's only been since May that this has been allowed. So we are seeing spending on both sides, but it went $410,000 to Republicans so far this cycle, and $273,000 to Democrats or liberal groups.
And this is all so far. Do you anticipate these 38 racking up more donations, or more people joining that list of 38 between now and Election Day?
I think either could happen. I would not be surprised to see any of these people joining the list, or others coming on to it. That could very easily happen. You know, the campaigns have about 6 weeks to the election. They will only be increasing their ask and seeking money anywhere they can as they race to November 4th.
One of the arguments people have made in favor of doing away with this cap on overall campaign donations, again, directly to political campaigns, is there's transparency. You still know who donated the money directly to the campaign, which with political action committees and outside groups, it's harder to know sometimes who donated that. Is that how it's playing out here?
That's exactly what the advocates of this say, is that, you know, we're going to have a lot of money in politics. It's better to have the public know, as I was saying, there are these outside groups where you can give, or corporations can give, and the public doesn't find out about it except in unusual situations. So the supporters of this say, look, this allows the public to analyze where a candidate is getting their money and whether they think that person supports what they support.
And the campaign finance reform community not buying it?
No, they say this just continues the escalation of money in campaigns, and that for every dollar that goes into on the disclosed side, many more dollars go in on the outside side, and that this will only fuel more money into elections.
And those political action committees, recently another cap, as I understand it, was removed on how much money can go to them.
Yeah, and this could be much more significant, but it only happened on Friday. The group CRG Network, which is Citizens for Responsible Government out of Milwaukee, 10 or more years ago, they were involved in a lot of recalls at the local level during the pension scandal in Milwaukee County. They sued because there's a similar limit on how much candidates can receive from a combination of political action committees. And so they had tried to give money to candidates who had already received the maximum PAC money that they could accept. And so U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa on Friday agreed with the CRG Network that appeared to be unconstitutional, and said that candidates can accept as much political action committee money as they want. They, from any particular PAC, there's a limit, but they can take it. There's no limit to the total amount of PAC money they can get. That could have big implications for elections. I think we'll have to see how that plays out, but that could mean a lot more PAC money in any given candidate's campaign coffers.
The big story at the national level seems to have been fewer and fewer restrictions on how much money can be donated and from whom. Is that the same story we're seeing here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, this story for the individuals that I wrote is, you know, directly a result of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in April. They struck down the aggregate limits for members of Congress, and so then when somebody was challenging the state limits, the federal court had to acknowledge what the U.S. Supreme Court did. So that's this continues that trend of restrictions on campaign finance being struck down over the years.
Well, Patrick, I'm sure you'll keep watching these numbers. Maybe we'll check in with you again in a month or two. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley. He's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's State House reporter, looking at a new report he wrote today showing political donations are up from Wisconsin's wealthiest donors this campaign after deregulations, as he just mentioned, from the U.S. Supreme Court this past year. Tomorrow, a new issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands, which means we have one of the magazine's editors here to give us a sneak peek at some of the coolest stories from the world of science this month.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, good to have you back.
Always great to be with you.
So this month you've got a feature looking at how security measures, things like fences on the Mexican-American border, are affecting the animal life there, animals like the pronghorn and jaguars. What are you finding? What's the link?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. It's such a hot topic now with all the concerns about illegal migration across the border, but no one's really talking about the fact that there are more than two dozen threatened or endangered species, including the pronghorn. As you mentioned, there's a pygmy owl, jaguars, other animals, that really they are getting just hemmed in. There is no place for them to go, and it's affecting their genetic diversity because of the fences, because of the highways, because of the increased grazing of cattle, and also just other elements of human development.
So the ecosystem for these animals doesn't obviously recognize the international border. So previous to these fences, they wandered back and forth as part of their natural deal, right?
Right, exactly. And that's what allowed genetic flow, you know, to make sure there was no inbreeding and that there was a healthy population. And, you know, one of the ironies is in the story, our writer goes along with members, a biologist and members of the Border Patrol, and they come to one of these 12-foot high walls that have been erected to keep people from crossing the border illegally. And the biologist says, you know, a person could get over that. An animal couldn't. And it's kind of this really sad irony. And these are pretty, you know, iconic animals of the American Southwest, whether you're talking about the pronghorn, the Sonoran pronghorn, which a lot of people misidentify as an antelope, but it's actually a different species, or, you know, the jaguar. There are all these animals that their populations are being disrupted, and as a result, they're not as healthy. Their numbers are shrinking, and it's really kind of tragic.
Is this primarily a story of genetic diversity and these fences stopping that from happening, or is it also about not available habitat for range and food?
Oh, absolutely. It's about that as well. And, you know, they talk about, we're all aware of that horrible drought we're having now in our western states, including that area. So, you know, they're already trying to survive the drought, trying to survive all these highways and other things. And now they've got drones in the air looking for people crossing the border illegally. You know, the trucks roaring up and down these desert areas, really disrupting them and stressing them out and making it even harder for them to survive. So it's definitely survival in terms of the individual animal finding sufficient food and water, but it's also survival of the population through healthy genetics.
Well, one thing I thought was really interesting was that scientists, the biologists here, are applying lessons from island biology to these, in effect, artificial islands that are being created by highways and borders.
Yeah, it's a theory called connectivity. And what they're looking to do is identify what they call safe corridors, ways that animals can move from one island, you know, from one isolated area to another. And they've gotten a lot of money, actually, from the Department of Homeland Security, which is trying to mitigate the damage being done. So they're getting money, and they're trying to apply it to find ways to identify these safe corridors and protect them to make it easier for the animals to get where they need to be and get the resources they need without compromising the border's integrity. It's a very tricky thing, but they're working on it.
Right, so right now you mentioned things like 12-foot fences. Are there alternatives to things like that that would be more animal-friendly but still have the desired effect immigration-wise, illegal immigration-wise?
Yeah, I know. I think you'll find a lot of different opinions on that. I think, you know, the biologists would certainly argue that there are different ways, whether they're things like animal overpasses and underpasses through the highways, things, by the way, that have been used successfully in Canada, not on the border, but just in busy national parks with a lot of highways. The Canadians have found ways to create, you know, safety corridors, artificial corridors like overpasses and underpasses that allow animals to maintain their territory. So there's a lot of discussion about that, but, you know, there's always the concern that, hey, if an animal can get through, a person can get through, and, you know, a person's going to be motivated to get through. So there's a lot of debate and contention in that area. There are options. We're just not sure if they're going to really work.
Well, moving on to another story of interest to us here in the radio world, evidently how people talk, something about our voices, can give a cue as to how tall we are. How does that work?
That is true, and you sound about 5'9 to me, am I right?
Whoa.
No, actually, 6'6".
5'9", dead on. Well done.
Wow. That was pretty impressive, Gemma.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I did meet you years ago, but anyway. These two experiments by Washington University psychologists. First, they had two people of the same sex but different heights read identical passages to people who couldn't see them, and people were able to say who was taller and who was shorter just by their voice. And they repeated, they had a different experiment where five people from the same sex read the same thing, and people had to rank them without seeing them by height, so ranking them solely by their voice but determining how tall they were. And they got that, too. They were able to tell, yeah, that guy's shorter than that guy. They think it all has to do with something called subglottal resonance, and that's actually really hard to say, subglottal resonance. Basically, taller people have larger lower airways, and it's in the lower airways that certain sounds are produced. And if you've got a larger lower airway, those sounds are able to reverberate and create a deeper pitch. So, you know, none of us are thinking about that, like, his subglottal resonance tells me. But on some, you know, subconscious level, we're very aware of that difference. And that enables us to say, yeah, that guy sounds tall. She sounds short, you know, whatever. So it's a really interesting find. And they think, you know, it might have actually some applicability in even criminal proceedings. If you have eyewitnesses, why not have ear witnesses?
Wow, that's really interesting. Could have all kinds of implications, I suppose. If you're thinking about dating and you talk to someone over the phone, does this voice make me look short? I don't know. It sounds like it's just the beginning of understanding how, you know, how we perceive height and what that means and how to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know about you, but I do sometimes, you know, talk to someone on the phone and think, wow, that sounds like, you know, a really big guy or, you know, whatever. And I'm picking up subconsciously on that subglottal resonance.
That was the original proposed name for our show, by the way, subglottal resonance. I want to say that again and again.
Once you're able to say it, you just can't stop saying it.
Central Time just barely nudged it up. But maybe we should reconsider it in light of this research.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one more story now before you go. The story about the creator of Guitar Hero, right? The console game all the youth are playing, and older people too, I gather. But he's up to some interesting new stuff.
Yeah, he does a lot of different things. And he describes himself as more like the godfather of Guitar Hero. Apparently, he lit the flame of inspiration and then helped guide some other people to create it. But he's definitely in the founding fathers of Guitar Hero. And he is looking at all the different ways sound has a relation to our health, both in can listening to sound improve our health, and also by listening to the sounds we make, can we diagnose potential health problems?
How would that work?
Well, it's actually really fascinating. There's this thing called Parkinson's Voice Initiative, and he mentions it briefly in the interview. It's actually you are able, the researchers, if you talk into a phone and do phonations, which are basically kind of the vocal sounds, and you make a series of phonations, and researchers record that telephone call, run it through some software, they are able to say whether or not you have Parkinson's, and they're actually able to diagnose earlier than standard tests, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. And it has to do with the level of vocal impairment, something you or I might not pick up on talking to someone, but the algorithms in the software actually enable the researchers to identify specific vocal impairments in the voice just by making phonations, again, the ah kind of open sounds, that can help diagnose Parkinson's early. And that is just, I mean, think about that. That is fantastic.
And then briefly, there was also mention in that of using musical training to help post-stroke patients learn how to talk again.
Yeah, he talks about another researcher who actually developed a melodic intonation theory, which is a specific set of steps where you teach someone to speak rhythmically with some pitch variations. Someone who has lost the ability to speak, such as after having a stroke, is able to learn to speak again much more quickly than traditional methods by following this kind of music-based method. They're not really sure how it works yet, but I think it's a wonderful illustration of how music can really, you know, be a healing process in our lives.
Well, Gemma, thanks so much, as always, for being with us today.
Always fun. Thank you, guys.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us each month to discuss some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. In June of 2013, the Pentagon announced that it would open tens of thousands of new positions for women serving in the military. Only a few roles, like special ops and infantry, remain off limits. Even so, the story of women who serve in the armed forces is anything but clear-cut.
Our next guest went in-depth with three women who enlisted in the Indiana National Guard and found themselves serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was a single mother of three, a student who wanted money for school, and a beauty salon manager.
In the book Soldier Girls, we get an inside view of what it really means to serve in the U.S. military as a woman and the impact that service has on the personal and professional sides of life.
Helen Thorpe joins us now. She's a journalist and the author of several books, including Just Like Us and her latest, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Helen, really glad to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be on the show.
Well, you start your book with the story of a woman you call Michelle Fisher, a young college student from Indiana. Can you tell us about her?
Sure. She, like many young people, was attracted by the college tuition benefits. She didn't really actually think of herself as somebody who wanted to join the military until she heard about the tuition benefits that were being offered. In the spring of 2001, she was 18 years old when she enlisted, and the country had not been at war for a long time. She thought it was safe to join the National Guard and that she would never get deployed overseas. She envisioned serving 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks in the summer, as was the norm for National Guard soldiers at that time. So she really enlisted because she wanted to go to college, and she was clear she didn't want to join the regular Army. But then 9/11 happened while she was in basic training, and she knew right away everything was going to be different than what she thought.
You paint the picture of her struggling those early days with some of the enhanced executive powers at wartime and her realizing at a certain point that she probably was going to end up going to war.
Yeah. Michelle and the two women that she becomes very, very close friends with during a deployment to Afghanistan, the three women are very different in many regards. There's 30 years difference from Michelle being the youngest to the oldest of the three women, and there's almost as much difference in terms of their political beliefs. Michelle had just voted for Ralph Nader in the preceding presidential election in 2000, and she would vote for him again while they were in Afghanistan in 2004. And she struggled always with the idea of the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, as she did not believe in those wars. She did not think they were an appropriate response to 9/11. The other two women she went on to become close friends with felt very differently about those conflicts. The oldest of the three women, Debbie, supported both wars. Meanwhile, the single mother with three children, whose name is Desma, she did support the war in Afghanistan. She was worried about the war in Iraq. She wasn't sure we had the troops to successfully complete a second war in a timely fashion. And Desma was somebody who had voted for George Bush in 2000. So Desma and Michelle and Debbie were people who might never have become close, except they deployed together, and then they formed really bonds almost like family during the course of their deployment.
Now let's talk about Desma for a bit. She was unusual in that she was a mother of three, and she had, it sounds like, the primary custody of these children, and traditionally single mothers are discouraged from enlisting for that very reason. How did that play out in her life?
Yeah. In her National Guard unit, Desma was not alone in finding herself a single parent as the deployments started happening. She had previously been married, but she had divorced. And the same was true for her best friend in the unit. She's a minor character in the book, but her name is Stacy Glory. So Desma and Stacy were two of a number of people in their guard unit who had previously been married, but were single parents at the point when the deployments came. And while it's true that the military does not actively recruit single parents with full custody of their children, nonetheless, people can become single parents over time. And if they're still in the military, they do get orders to deploy. And Desma felt it was her job to obey those orders and to find
other people to take custody of her children when the deployment orders came. As a civilian, that was hard for me to understand. I'm a mother, and I did ask her quite pointedly about it. You know, couldn't you have stayed home with your children? Might they not have been better off? And she explained it in her guard unit, and I think people in the military understand this to be true, that the cohesion is so great that you're just considered a terrible person, a pariah. In her words, she said, I would have been a dirt bag if I had chosen to stay home. I know that's a really strong word for her to use, but that was the word she chose for how she would have felt about herself if she had let everybody else in the unit go without her.
Now, these women all had a common experience in that they were living and working in a male-dominated world, the military. Not only that, but they were serving in countries where women led lives that were much more restricted.
Yeah.
How did that affect their careers there?
You see it affect each of the women differently over time, and the two deployments themselves were different. For Michelle, as the youngest, as a very attractive young woman living on a military post, she was 21 by the time she deployed to Afghanistan in this very largely male environment. For her, it was an atmosphere of just constant male attention. She was propositioned from dawn to dusk every day of her deployment. And, you know, in a military uniform, you have your last name is on your uniform and your name tag there. And so people would call out to her all throughout the day as if they knew her by name, men she'd never met before. Their support battalion was about 2-to-1 men to women, but then many of the units they were serving alongside were all male. So the ratio was even more skewed on the post as a whole. Meanwhile, for Debbie, as the oldest of the three women, she was 52 when they deployed to Afghanistan. She became a grandmother while they were serving there. She sometimes felt wistful looking at all of the attention that the younger women were getting, and she was not receiving that sort of attention from her male colleagues. And, you know, so she viewed that attention differently. For Michelle, it was oppressive. She didn't like it. Whereas Debbie was thinking kind of nostalgically of the time when men paid that much attention to her. Debbie also really wanted to go on the deployments. It had been a lifelong dream of hers to go overseas. She viewed the time in Afghanistan as a highlight of her life. So Michelle didn't want to go to Afghanistan. Debbie really wanted to go. And earlier in the book, you see them put in a funny position where Michelle is given a spot in the deployment that Debbie thinks is her spot on the armament team. And Debbie has to sort of argue her way on, and she's asking, how come this younger woman's going in my place? So they respond in very different ways, but for Debbie in that moment, it's almost gender discrimination or age discrimination, rather, I should say, that she feels that she's facing as an older woman, that she's being left behind or not viewed as equally competent. So really different things happen to the different women over the course of the two deployments. Those are just a few examples.
So to go with something that seems pretty common for younger women, Michelle ends up almost being badgered by some of her senior officers who are men to have relationships with them. And it's almost becomes sort of half coercion and half symbiotic in that she then gets protection from this man, from the other men and from protection in general. Is that how you see that relationship that sometimes happened?
So you're absolutely right that Michelle was badgered, including by some, NCOs or people who had non-commissioned officers, people who had authority over her. She does successfully resist those advances. There's one guy she gives an awful nickname to. She starts calling him Nose Hairs because she finds this older man sort of not physically attractive at all, and he's doing weird things like putting his cot right next to hers if she's during annual training. He's going to sleep right next to her, so she'll wake up with her face right next to his, and she finds this behavior really reprehensible, and she manages to steer clear of him. She does go on to form a relationship during the deployment to Afghanistan with another soldier. He's not somebody who has authority over her. He's a peer. But you're right in that she herself feels that relationship offers her protection by being in a relationship with him. Then the other men start to leave her alone, and she feels some relief. And she doesn't have so many people coming to try to sit with her at every meal. She just knows she's going to sit with this one guy that she gets involved with. And for her, it does offer her a sense of security that other people would leave her alone then.
And Desma, moving to Desma, the mother of three, she had a rougher time of it than some of the other women. And she really feared for her life at a certain point. And she felt like she wasn't getting the support she needed to stay safe in Afghanistan and other places from her company. What happened there?
So Desma is, during the Afghanistan deployment, she's doing the kind of work that she originally trained to do. She has essentially a desk job. She's working in the motor pool on a computer tracking maintenance on vehicles. She's part of a support battalion that's supporting infantry soldiers, and they're maintaining the vehicles that the infantry soldiers are using on their missions. Several years later, when she's deployed to Iraq, however, she's doing work that is far more dangerous. She is, at that point, their guard unit, their support battalion, is actually not deployed as a coherent whole, but rather it's broken up and spread across their brigade wherever other units need soldiers. And Desma finds herself in a formerly all-male field artillery regiment, and she's asked to do convoy security, and that means she's asked to drive a gun truck on the highways of Iraq and to help look for roadside bombs. The work is far more dangerous. It's not what she originally trained to do, and she doesn't feel that she has the same training as some of the other people that she's serving alongside. She does ultimately, there are several explosions that affect different people in the book. She does hit a roadside bomb at a certain point in time, and I don't want to spoil everything for the reader. You do see her kind of emerge successfully over time from that ordeal, but yes, it's pretty harrowing, and the impact on her and her three children is pretty immense.
We're talking right now with Helen Thorpe. She's the author of the new book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. And we're talking about what it's like for women today to serve in the armed forces.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a woman serving in the armed forces, or maybe a family member or friend is in that position? Is the military a place where women can contribute and belong, or is there still work to be done? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking to journalist Helen Thorpe now. She's giving us the inside view of what it's like for women in the military. She profiled three women who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she's the author of the new book called Soldier Girls.
And we want to hear from you. Are you, or is a family member or a friend, a woman serving in the armed forces now, past or present, here in the U.S., or maybe you served in Iraq or Afghanistan? Is the military a hostile environment for women, or a place that women can contribute and belong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
Helen, obviously these three women had different experiences in the military, and they were different people at different stages of their life with different family situations. But were there areas that they agreed upon about common experiences in the military, either things that they really needed to change or that served them well?
You know, I think that all three of them, even though Michelle opposed both of the wars and Desma was skeptical about the second, I think all three of them found their deployment to Afghanistan to be life-changing and very, very valuable. And even Michelle said that she would not take that year back if she, you know, could wave a magic wand and have that choice. So I know that they found serving alongside of each other to be one of the most rewarding things that they ever went through. I think all of them would change certain things. I think that they happened to serve in a National Guard unit where some of their chain of command, as you had mentioned earlier in the conversation, were sort of setting the example that it was okay to hit on younger women, maybe even if you had authority over them. And so I think all of them felt that their chain of command, that there were issues there. I know that when Desma went on to serve in Iraq, she was transferred into two different previously all-male units. She served first in an infantry regiment during her Iraq deployment, and that experience was so uncomfortable that she requested a transfer and then ended up in the previously all-male field artillery regiment that I mentioned earlier. When she was serving with the infantry soldiers, they had never trained with women before. And suddenly she was being sent to a war zone with men who'd never trained with women before. And I spoke both with Desma, but also some of the other women who were at the same time transferred into that previously all-male infantry regiment. And all of them said, if the guys have never trained with women before, you can't expect it to go very well. That's not something they would recommend anybody do again. They were treated quite well in the field artillery regiment, which, again, had been previously all male. But some of those men had trained with women previously during their basic training, and so they had the experience of working alongside women in the military back there in their memories, and they treated the women in the field artillery regiment who joined them temporarily very well. Women aren't supposed to be in an infantry regiment or a field artillery regiment, but they were allowed in those units temporarily during the Iraq deployment because those units were serving in a support capacity and they were doing convoy security. So women joined them temporarily. It was a very unusual set of circumstances. And the fact that Desma had two very different experiences in the two different groups, I thought was really interesting. The leadership can really set a tone as well. You know, the field artillery regiment, their leaders really set a tone that it was important to treat women with respect and dignity, and that's what happened there.
Let's get our callers in on this. Mary joins us now in Wauwatosa, and you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What experience have you or your family had with serving in the military as a woman, and what's working, what might need to change? Mary, hi, you're on Central Time.
Hi. I served 28 years in the military in both active duty and reserve, and I did not put boots in the sand because I was injured in a chemical explosion during combat training. However, I would not trade those 28 years for anything. There has not been a time that... men have always had an issue with women in the workforce. And if you look at your history, whether it's civilian or military, it's always been a threat to many of beyond the revolution, for many of the men, when women start coming in and proving their competence. And I have a daughter who's going on her 17th year in the military, and she has had 5 deployments, to include that she earned the bronze medal for, basically taking out, 3 different times, a cell of Taliban. Not that this is, you know, they don't promote that kind of information out. And she's currently going on deployments where she goes in and provides medical care as a nurse and knows for our personnel. And she has PTSD like the rest of us. And I have a daughter in the Coast Guard. And the leadership opportunities are there. The mistakes that were done by these guard, sometimes reserve units, people have to remember we're talking about units with people who are essentially the microcosm of the communities. And when you look at units, for example, here in Wisconsin, with a state that has a high amount of family abuse, wife abuse, rape, and so forth, it just carries over to where they're at.
And I'm going to jump in now, Mary, just so we can get our guest in on this. Thank you so much for sharing your family's history with the military. You've served 28 years. Your daughters are in the military. And Mary making the case that this has been invaluable for her. She wouldn't trade it. And the problems you see in the military are the problems that you see everywhere. And it's just society in a microcosm. Do you think that the women you spoke with would agree?
I do, and I would add that I think, you know, the members of Mary's family, her daughters, and the women in my book, what was most stressful over the last decade were the lengthy multiple deployments, and you know, it's especially stressful, hard on active duty families who serve more frequently, many times, even than individuals in the Guard. But the women in the Guard that I was writing about, they really had never anticipated ever going overseas in the first place. So it was so outside of what they had envisioned they were committing to, and yet they really tried to step forward and honor the commitment, even though the terms had changed from what they had originally pictured. But the lengthy multiple deployments that we saw, I think, you know, the impact on children especially, it was very rough. And I felt so grateful that the women I was writing about shared. Debbie kept 6 diaries. Desma shared her entire VA file, including therapy notes. Michelle had been writing very long letters and emails to family, and then when others deployed to Iraq and she didn't go to Iraq, she was writing to all her friends in Iraq. And all of that material, you get to really hear the women speak in their own voices about the impact that these experiences had on them. And I think their voices are, it was an honor for me to get to have that material and to share it with readers, because I think that's what's so compelling.
In our last 30 seconds here, Helen, as we hear headlines about sexual assault in the military, about discrimination, were you surprised at how positive these women's experiences in many cases seem to be?
You know, they did not bring up with me the subject of sexual assault. I brought it up with them and said, listen, I keep reading about it. You're not bringing it up. You're often saying very positive things. How about these sexual assaults? Did you know people? And they each had stories. Desma had been assaulted by a military recruiter early in her career, though not when she was deployed. Debbie knew a woman who was probably raped in a shower that Debbie frequently went to, and she warned Debbie. The assaults were terrible. Being assaulted by a colleague, by another member of the military that you view as part of your family, is a terrible experience. The women that I was writing about did not have that experience while overseas, but through them, you understand the atmosphere in which those assaults took place.
We leave it there. Helen, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Helen Thorpe, journalist and the author of the new book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of 3 Women at War and at Home.